TBRI.
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 TOVD.
TBRI.
TBRI. Trust-based relational intervention.
TBRI is an attachment-based
trauma-informed intervention
that is designed to meet the complex needs
of vulnerable children.
TBRI uses empowering principles
to address physical needs,
connecting principles for attachment needs,
and correcting principles to disarm fear-based behaviors.
While TBRI is based on years of attachment, sensory processing, and neuroscience research,
the heartbeat of TBRI is connection.
Hello and welcome back for season 8 of the TBRI podcast. You're listening to episode 1. On this show, we talk all about trust-based relational intervention, or TBRI. We talk about different elements of the model itself, and also about how TBRI is applied in various systems of care and practice. I'm Emily Pickett, producer of the podcast, and today we are chatting with Marty Smith. Marty is an occupational therapist, a TBRI practitioner, and a second-time author. Today, we are chatting with Marty all about her new book, Sensory Healing After Developmental Trauma. You guys, this book is a game changer. Whether you are a professional working with kids or if you're a caregiver with kiddos, this book is such a wise and accessible guide for navigating sensory challenges that are brought on by trauma. The book includes a wide range of low-cost, budgeted activities that can be applied in various settings, including juvenile justice, rehab, schools, homes, residential care, and foster homes, all of which include guidance on how to engage the wider community in order to maximize the potential for healing. Y'all are going to love this conversation, and you will love Marty's book even more. Be sure to check out the show notes to see where you can order Sensory Healing After Developmental Trauma. Thanks so much for being here with us, and please enjoy this conversation with Marty Smith and Sarah Mercado.
Hi, Marty.
Hello. Thanks for having me back.
Boy, isn't this an exciting one?
It is. It is.
I feel like we're about to let a cat out of the bag. So you wrote another book.
I did.
Oh my gosh. And I have had the privilege of reading most of it. I haven't made my way through the whole thing yet. Would you share with us, how did it come to be? What's it about? Tell us a little bit more.
All right. Well, to be fair, I haven't been able to give you like the copy until last week because I just got my own author copies. So this is kind of exciting. We're recording this before it actually launches. It comes out March 21st. And so here's my copy. It's called Sensory Healing After Developmental Trauma, The Connected Therapist's Guide to Low-Cost Activities for Working with Children. It's kind of a follow-up to the Connected Therapist. The Connected Therapist is kind of my story of how TBRI and Dr. Perry's work in the NMT really springboarded me from just working with the sensory systems from a framework of, working with kids diagnosed with autism and kind of the more school-based practice versus going into the trauma, working with adoption and kids who have experienced adversity and stuff, and kind of my work with you guys. So the Connected Therapist was a bit of my journey, the first half of how did I become trauma aware and trauma responsive? And then the second half is how do the sensory systems develop and how are they impacted by trauma? And then this book actually came about, I was talking about the Connected Therapist on Robin Goble's podcast. She's a friend of mine. And she was getting ready to launch, to pitch the idea of her raising kids with big baffling behaviors to Jessica Kinsley Publishing. But as part of that, they heard me and they said, hey, can we have the Connected Therapist? And I was like, no, that's my baby. And I didn't really want it to be this big thing. It's personal. It's my personal story, right?
Right,
and so
right.
A lot of vulnerability, and the idea of turning that over to someone who would market it was terrifying. And so, and now I'm better. Like now I realize how many people my personal story has helped. And I didn't know that at the time. I didn't realize how people would find healing through hearing about my journey a little bit, but it still is very vulnerable. So I didn't want to give up control of that book. And so then they said, would you write another one? And I was like, I mean, I guess. So we kind of brainstormed around, and a couple of years ago, probably 10 years ago or so, Rob and I, my husband, who's a software developer, we developed a website or an app, if you will, called The Calmer, which is K-A-L-M-E-R or A-R. And it stands for Kaya, Anna, Lynn Marie, Marty, and Rob. It's our initials of some friends in Norway. And so I was in Norway and they said, hey, how do we know what activities to recommend when you leave? You know, I did this big training and they're like, how do we have your brain for when you're not in our country? And so Rob was like, well, we could kind of use the framework of Dr. Perry's NMT and write it for OT specific goals. And so instead of just telling you kind of, you know, giving you the map of the brain, if you will, of his NMT, it gives you a smaller OT specific only map that then gives activity guidelines. And so we kind of took that app, the Calmer app, and made a book out of it. So now the sensory healing book is the first part of the book is going through some of the neurology and the things that we learn when we study how trauma impacts the nervous system. And so there's a little bit of the polyvagal theory. There's a lot of Dr. Perry's arousal continuum work in there. There's TBRI's attachment work in there. And so kind of putting a lot of the frameworks. There's also Tracy Stackhouse is a really dear friend of mine. And she does a lot with this sensory processing integration or sensory integrative processing. And she does a lot of neuro as far as sensory work. And so a lot of her work is kind of my interpretation of that and just having conversations with her. And she did help with the book even. And so it was kind of like this framework of when we understand the theory behind why we have to treat people who have experienced diversity differently and how that impacts their nervous system. Let's unpack that, the first half of this book. And then the second half of the book is, okay, let's go using Dr. Perry's framework and the Calmer framework. Let's go by brain hierarchy and really get into some strategies that will remediate or rehab those different brain structures. So then, you know, we kind of go through the theory in the beginning. And I try to make it very relatable. So even parents and, you know, caregivers and things like it, it will be a little... You might have to read the sentence twice, but it's not language. understand.
I have one I read like 10 times just to try to load it in because I was like, I don't want to forget that. I don't want to forget that. It wasn't the complexity of it, but it was like, Sarah, get it. Like, get this part, right? Wow, it's so exciting. It's fun to hear the whole story. I, you know, heard parts of it, but not the whole thing all put together. Really quickly for our listeners, and we'll link it in the show notes, but where do they find the Calmer app?
The Calmer app is Calmer, K-A-L-M-A-R dot creative therapies, which is my website, .com.
And we'll link it in the show notes so people don't have to go digging around. Before we get like too far into the book, you spend a whole lot of time talking about co-regulation, what it is, all of that. But would you just tell us really quickly, you know, explain co-regulation and then why is it so dang important?
Yeah. And really when we look at, because this book is based on Calmer, which is a developmental sequence, a developmentally appropriate, developmentally mindful approach where you have to kind of have the foundation before you can go further. You know, we're looking at the brainstem foundation, then we can get into the more limbic structures and then the cortical structures. So when we look at the act of regulation, so many of my kids come to me for therapy for self-regulation. But if we go back developmentally, you had to co-regulate before you can self-regulate. Mm-hmm. So co-regulation is that act of being in the presence of someone who is what Dr. Perry will call the power differential, right? Like someone has more power in the relationship than the other person, you know, whether it's an authority figure or, you know, perceived trust and safety and those kinds of things. That's just kind of how that relationship works, especially for infants. Obviously, the parent is in a, you know, has the control or the autonomy, you know, of the situation. And so when you're learning to regulate, it's that person who has that perceived power differential, you will mimic their nervous system. And so that's the whole, when, you know, when the baby, and Karen talks about this, Dr. Purvis talked about this a lot, you know, when the baby is cold, I will clothe you. When the baby is hungry, I will feed you. And it's those, you had a need and I helped you meet it. And through that, your body regulates, right? The regulate is a verb that basically means you're adjusting and modifying to the situation. Mm-hmm. And so I'll talk about like, we regulate, you know, our diabetes. So, you know, we regulate the amount of insulin that goes in and out based on our sugars and things like that. I'm a big scuba diver. And so we have a regulator is what kind of it tampers the amount of oxygen that comes in as we're breathing underwater. So to regulate really just means to take in a snapshot of the current situation and then say, how do I need to adjust the levels of something to make it work properly? And so when we talk about emotional or physical or, you know, arousal, meaning like activation and alertness, you know, that's how I'm using the term arousal. But to regulate those things, we have to kind of take a snapshot of the moment. And then we have to adjust our internal workings to adapt to that moment, right? And so that co-regulation, that you can't self-regulate until someone has shown you how to do it. So it's like co-regulation is really where it starts to know, you know, that hunger can be satisfied by food and to know that using the toilet helps my bowels feel better, you know, like
these
are things, you know, and if you even think about that, like the caregiver, like we bicycle their legs to help get the gas out. We pat them to get the gas. These things that keep our body feeling safe and connected, they were all kind of taught to us by a caregiver through that co-regulation. And so even as we get older, as we move into that arousal continuum and our perceived safety decreases, we will still look to someone who has a power differential for that safety. So if we're in a classroom and an alarm goes off, we're going to look to the teacher and that teacher is going to co-regulate us. When we are crossing the street and a car is coming down, you know, we're going to look to whoever, you know, is the biggest person, you know, we're going to wait for this car. And so it can be siblings. You can co-regulate with siblings. You can co-regulate. You could go on a horse. Like my friend, Michael is a big horse guy and he and I are equals. Like we are not over each other, but if I'm on a horse, he has the power differential because he's the horse guy. So if I'm trying to regulate my body to be safe on this horse, I'm going to co-regulate with Michael because I know that he's going to keep me safe because he has more knowledge in that situation. So it's really situation dependent and it really has nothing to do with like, I'm your boss and, you know, things like that. But even like right now, I'm going to co-regulate with you because you're in charge of this podcast. And so I'm following your lead, you know, on how to do it. So.
It is true. It's one of the things I was going to say is that, I want to move on into the book, but I have never heard regulation explained in such a way. So I feel like my brain is spinning a little bit, but one of the things I always think about when I think about co-regulation and even, you know, how regulation is developed is that as adults, and this could just be me, but I always expect more out of our kids than I expect out of myself. And so I can be dysregulated, but they can't and such and such and such. But the truth is as a full grown woman, I still depend on people to help me regulate. Right. Absolutely. Just like you said, like we are constantly in this back and forth of regulation and meeting the needs and going back and forth to make sure that we remain regulated for the task at hand. Right.
Yeah. Like, and you know, you know, I might co-regulate with you. Like, this is a moment of co-regulation. Sarah, I'm publishing a book.
Right.
And you, and you get excited. Right. We just co-regulated and we regulated ourselves up. Right. We regulated into the more activation. If I was in scuba, then my regulator would have let more air in because I just saw an eel. Right. Like I would have pulled more air. My regulator would have said, okay, we're going to access more because this situation needs more activation. And so, you know, that's one of my passions is when people talk about, you know, self-regulation, you know, like, you know, Robin will even go so far as, and I think it's Robin, but there is no self-regulation. Like you're always regulating with someone else.
Right. Right.
Whether it's an animal, it could be an animal. It you know, it doesn't always have to be human, but you are always monitoring your level of activation based on other things.
Dr. Casey Call used to say one of her mantras when her kids were little was, it's my job to help you regulate. It's like something she would repeat when, you know, dysregulation was happening and she was frustrated, right? It's hard to be a mom. It's hard to be a parent. It's hard to be a caregiver.
And she would just say in her head, like, she, it's my job to help you regulate. It's my job to help. And that for her was self-regulation. Absolutely. And prep to co-regulate.
And I'm just going to, I know we'll move on from this, but she was kind of pulling back from people that weren't even in the room with her. So mm-hmm. that's something too, is you can co-regulate with a thought that came yeah. behind, you know, like you can co-regulate onto knowledge that you received prior. Like I yeah. could co-regulate and be thinking about my grandma cooking cookies, right? Mm. And I'm still co-regulating with my grandma who's passed away, right? But I'm yeah. still pulling on that memory of her to co-regulate in that moment.
Wow. That's incredible.
So cool.
Yeah. All right. Let's get on to the book because we're about to have a whole episode on regulation if because I'm getting upregulated about regulation. But not many people say that, Marty. It's fine. Everything's fine. Okay. So I started to read the book and I was like, oh man, okay, this is for professionals, maybe specifically occupational therapists. And then I kept reading and I was like, oh no, 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 no. This is literally for everyone. I love, for me, the combination of science that is broken down into the everyday with really easy to use interventions and suggestions. And I love that you even said in the beginning, these are all low cost because you know, you may not be able to see her right now, but Marty's in her, I'm assuming, your therapy room, and there's Lycra hanging from the ceilings and all the things, right? We may not be able to provide all of that. And I love that this book brought the balance of the science and the why we need to do it with, here's some things to try when this is going on. And then you broke it down throughout the brain. So let's chat through a few parts of it. And then I want to read a couple of quotes from the book. And then I'd like for us to just give a couple of nuggets from kind of each chapter so people can understand what they're going to get when they go by this.
I'll just say, like, The Connected Therapist was kind of meant to be read front to back. And this book was really not meant to be read front to back. Oh. It's kind of a choose your own adventure where the beginning of it is some of the neuroscience and the frameworks. But then when you get into the back of it, it kind of walks you through doing the Calmer app. And so if you're really having trouble with sleep, just turn to that sleep chapter because it really goes kind of segment by segment of this is my goal. And then here are some activities that you can try. And so it really was meant to be led. And there's a lot of charts and a lot of graphs that, you know, the end of the book actually reads pretty fast because you're not meant to read all of it. Like not everybody has all of these things. And so it's kind of a, you know, pick and choose what's going to happen. And then in the back, there is a chapter at the end of, I had a course that I ran for several years called PT and OT on a Shoestring Budget. And I taught people how to do these hammocks behind me and all that just by buying stuff at Joann Fabrics or their fabric store or whatnot. So that you can have a low budget and easy to install. So there's a lot of tutorials for making your own equipment. And I really have a passion for working with people, mission work and things like that, where you just don't have a lot of supplies and making do. Mm-hmm. So that is kind of what the book was made. Yes, it was written for everybody, but it also is not meant to be read cover to cover. It's meant to be kind of perused through.
Oh, that's really good to know. I love it might be pulling on my Gen X heartstrings, but a choose your own adventure.
Yeah,
it takes me back to road trips, reading through those books. No, that's awesome. And it's so helpful. And sometimes the adventure is not the adventure we want to be on, but to be able to turn to the page and get a little map of what you need is so helpful. Okay. In the beginning chapter, it's titled Safety, Regulation, and Resilience. You kind of talk about activity analysis. And so I want to read you a quote and then I'm going to kind of ask you, what does this activity analysis mean? Because this is, I said in the beginning, there were a couple of lines that I just kept reading over and over and over because I wanted to lodge it in my brain, not because it was complex, but I'd like to talk through just a couple of those. You were talking about doing a hard task with a kid, I believe, in this moment. And you said, alongside them, I can model how to make their bed while talking about how snuggly it's going to be and what great dreams I hope they're going to have. This approach facilitates an entirely different outcome than telling them they can't watch their favorite show until it's done and then enduring the inevitable quote unquote behavior that will ensue because I asked them to do a thing that felt like it was big and ambiguous. The biggest therapeutic impact I can have with my clients is to walk alongside them to model and co-regulate with them as we do these difficult things together. And I underlined, I don't believe you did, as we do these difficult things together. This hit me so hard because I am, with my history, with my attachment style, with all of the things I have going, I want to motivate with some sort of reward, right? I want to get the task done. I want it to be over with. I don't want to be a part of it, to be quite honest. Like, just go make your bed and then we can do this fun thing. And so that's why I kept reading this over and over and over. How does activity analysis relate to this particular quote?
Yeah. So in that portion of the book, I'm talking about, you know, a case that I've seen, right, where, you know, someone is told you need to go clean your room. Mm-hmm. And the person assumes I have to organize my knickknacks and I have to alphabetize, you know, my color of my shoes. Like, they're taking it so far because they don't know what you mean. And you might have meant, like, I just need you to, like, pick your clothes off the floor. You know,
mm-hmm. Like, right.
But some kids, you know, especially if they like have to do all or nothing, right? That's kind of their mentality. Mm-hmm. And because of their background, perfectionism and people pleasing and all this kind of stuff, they feel like the task is so big that they can't possibly do it. So then they're just going to not, and then they just refuse. But if you're along there with them and you're modeling and you're clarifying and you're encouraging with them, it's like, no, baby, I didn't mean you had to like shine your shoes. You just need to get them off the floor. You know,
right.
Because a lot of kids will make assumptions based on their mm-hmm. past experiences, and then you're there. So the activity analysis comes in, because that's a very OT specific term of, anytime we want to rehab someone or have a goal for rehab, we're going to look at the activity that they're trying to do. So let's say you want to tie your shoes. I'm going to be like, well, do you have the finger strength to hold on to the laces? Do mm-hmm. you have two hands to be able to do both sides of the lace? Or do I need to modify that for a one-handed shoeing technique, two-tie technique? Do I need to get you elastic shoelaces so that you don't have to tie them at all? So mm-hmm. activity analysis is looking at, what is your goal activity and how do we break it into the smallest of steps and then figure out what step are they having trouble with? And so in the case of coming alongside them, the intent of that story is, if someone can't do what you're asking them to do, or they won't, you know, if that's that whole, you know, Dr. Green's, you know, it's about skill, not will, right?
Mm-hmm.
If they're not doing it, it's because they can't do it. And so mm-hmm. as the co-regulators, as the parents and caregivers, we need to sit down and go, if they're not doing the task, they feel like they can't, but what part of it can't they do? Mm-hmm. And is it this reminds them of something, so then they're having a psychological barrier? Is it a strength issue? The OTs, so often we find like these kids have poor visual skills. They have poor core strength. You know, like if you want someone to make their bed and they don't have the core strength to hold the covers against resistance, they're not going to be successful. And then they're going to be embarrassed. And so then they just will become the class clown kind of situation. But it's that finding out, what is the task you want them to do? And what part of that task are they really getting hung up on? And that's the activity analysis. You're analyzing the whole steps for that activity. And OTs are trained to do that. And that's why it's so good to have on your team, because we see patterns a lot.
Yeah.
We've analyzed activities as part of our coursework. And so, you know, when someone's like, he won't brush his teeth, well, there's a million reasons that a kid won't brush their teeth. And as an OT, we've studied those reasons by doing activity analysis. So mm-hmm. is it the flavor of the toothbrush? Is it the vibration of the toothbrush? Is it the strength of being able to hold it? Is it the stamina? You know, like, we have all of these things that we've already thought through for you.
But you know, even as a parent or caregiver, if I'm in tune with my own history, like I was talking about earlier, and I'm just saying like, clean your room or make your bed or do the dishes or, you know, whatever, right? There's a list every single day of things that we could try to get our kids to do. And I begin to think through this framework. I'm definitely not a trained OT. This was the first time I've even read about it, but I can apply that
as
the layperson of just going like, okay, where are we getting hemmed up? Because usually it's at clean your room, right? Like, that's the first part where we stop and it's like, nothing's happening, right? Like, why did I walk in and you're laying on the bed? And I mean, just pick one thing and pick it up. Like, I'm not asking you to, you know, shine the floors. I'm just saying, like, let's see the floor. Let's see if we can find it. Right. Exactly. And so as a parent and a caregiver, it makes me think when I see that pause in my kid, not to look for at defiance and not to raise the structure, but actually come in alongside with the idea of co-regulation, with the idea of, like, I love in the bed making, like, this is going to be a cozy bed. I hope you have great dreams. Like, it sounds like who I want to be. Yes. It actually, you know what I mean? Like, when I see these videos of these parents, I'm like, I want to be that.
Yeah. And so I feel like if I can borrow that script, you know, and maybe hit 50% of it, right? Like, if I'm going to be just think of how cozy it'll be. You know, you don't even have to talk about the dreams. Like, I'm going to give you a script of all these things and just do 50% of them, you know.
Right. Yeah.
But I totally agree. You know, like, that's who I want to be. And if we keep trying to be that person, eventually we will become, because practice and repetition will build new neural networks. But it's the same for our kids. And that's where when we, and again, the connected therapist, I talk ad nauseum about this, about coming alongside, having a buddy, you know, and that co-regulation is so important. And then we're in tune as well to when we're alongside them, we can see their perspective sometimes too, just being on their level. You're like, oh, I didn't realize you had stuffed everything under your bed. So your coping strategy of throwing things under your bed isn't working for you this week because the bed's full.
Right. There's nowhere else to put it.
But that's why you could do it last week and you can't do it this week, because your strategy has to do it because of the current situation. And it's just even you acknowledging, like, I don't want to be involved in this. I just want you to do it.
Right. And I don't.
That's because of your history. But because you know that's your history, you can activity analysis. Okay, that's where I'm going to go with this. And that's where I need to change. Yeah, I need to change that framework, because that's not serving the purpose for me right now.
Right.
So I have to actually, and sometimes, you know, as caregivers, we have to recognize that sometimes the change is within ourselves more than the kid. It's increasing.
What? Come on, Marty. Don't tell us that. I know. I've always said that really TBRI, and maybe it's trauma-informed work, is really about changing the adults and our perspective, and it, because the kids are the kids, right? Their experiences are driving everything they're doing. And it turns out I probably need to do things differently instead of, anyway, it's true.
That's another podcast, isn't it? And we would both be good on that podcast.
Oh, no. I know. It's terrible. It's terrible, but it is true. And that's why we do all the hard work we do, right? So that I can actually go into my kid's room and be like, where should we start? How about we just start with all of the shirts that are black?
Yeah.
Or, you know what I mean? Like, let's break it for, I'm learning with, you know, or I learned a long time ago with mine. It was like, we have to break this down because it's too much. So when we talk about will versus skill, are they even able to look at all of this that's happening and metabolize it and turn around and do something about it? Or do they get overwhelmed and shut down? And so turns out when you're shutting down, you might need a co-regulator.
It's true.
I feel stress. Okay.
We can co-regulate through that.
Breathe a little. Thanks, buddy. I appreciate that. All right. When talking about resilience, you quote Dr. Perry saying, you know, in his teaching, he states that when a stressor is unpredictable, uncontrollable, or severe, the individual is more likely to become vulnerable. When the stressor is predictable, controllable, and mild, the individual is more likely to become resilient. So, my goodness, the idea that I can create more vulnerability in an already vulnerable child simply by creating a lack of predictability, something they can't control, and something severe, right? Could be any myriad of things, right? Like, I actually increase their vulnerability versus if I do the opposite, I create resilience. So can you just talk me through that?
Yes. First of all, I would point the listener to Dr. Perry's work, like to go and hear it from the source, right? I'm going to give you a 3-minute summary of my interpretation of this work, but he gives you the full 30 minutes from his mouth. And I highly recommend that you go. You
know, okay.
listen to
and we'll link that. That'll be in the show notes.
From what I'm talking about in this scenario and my interpretation of his work is when we have, so when I think through how the brain gives energy to something and what our brain is going to focus on. And so when we focus on something, then we have those neural pathways that we've created. And so kind of getting into the brain science of how do we move towards action or learning and things like that. And is something predictable or not? So things that are new that we've not experienced before, we are going to have an activation in our brain. And so we're going to have to use more energy to understand it. We're going to be more likely to misunderstand it because it's the first time we've been experiencing it. And the brain knows this. And so I kind of give the example of when you're driving in the car and you're going to work, right? And you get there and somebody was like, oh, did you hear this song on the radio? For one, we aren't listening to the same stations anymore, but you know, like what song are you listening to on the way in? You may not be able to tell them because you weren't really paying attention to the outside stimuli. You were kind of on autopilot because the brain had been there before. It could predict what was going to happen. So you didn't take the energy. There was very little energy being exerted to make sense of that situation versus you're driving in a new city. You have to actually turn the radio down. You have to tell people not to talk to you. It's the same task, but it's different. So it's not predictable. Then your brain has to really work. And then you're tired. You know, once you have a commute, the first couple weeks of your commute, you're exhausted. And then once it becomes part of your routine, you're not as tired about it. And so that's kind of how the brain focuses its energy is on, have I been here before? How did it work out for me? You know, can I survive this? Do I know that I'm going to survive it? And so that's where we get into types of trauma where if you have a trauma that's predictable, the brain kind of goes, I've been here. I made it. I know what to do. I'm not going to have to exhaust my energy on this situation. And so the brain can then have energy to learn math facts and learn things that you enjoy. And you can kind of compartmentalize things a little bit easier. But when you have this unpredictability, the brain is spending so much of its power and its energy just trying to figure out, how do I keep myself safe? It's almost like, I know I'm not safe.
Right.
I've got these coping strategies that work, so I'm going to lean on them. And that's going to make my brain feel okay. It may be dysfunctional, right? Or not dysfunctional, but like it may not be ideal, your coping strategy. You've developed them versus that chaotic, uncontrollable. And also the other thing that I like to really point out is control and prediction are almost interchangeable. Because when I have control of a situation, I can predict what's going to happen. And if predictability calms my brainstem and it calms the regulatory functions of my brain so that I can access the cortical functions, the thinking parts of my brain, then having control of something actually helps me be less vulnerable.
Because
I have predictive capacity because I know what's coming, I control it. So when the child is being manipulative or controlling, I really encourage parents to step back and say, are they really just trying to calm the brainstem by making this situation predictable? Because when it is, we learn that the brain does not get so stuck in those areas and they can actually have access to the more thoughtful parts of the brain in those scenarios. And so, you know, Dr. Perry also talks a lot about timing of the event or the trauma. And, you know, if you can calm the brainstem and you have those regulatory functions that develop really early, then you can handle what's about to come, right? Like you've got a capacity. So when you have early adversity in those first 2 months, when you're learning to moderate and regulate your heart rate and your breath support and your eyes and all of those things, if those things don't develop appropriately, you don't have the foundation later in life. And so it's kind of the same thing here, is if the stress is predictable, I have control over it, it's patterned, it's repetitive, and it's mild or moderate, you know,
my brain
can actually build that foundation and keep the brainstem calm so that I can access those hierarchy features. But if it's sporadic, if it's, I feel no predictability towards it whatsoever, I have no control over it, then my brain is constantly trying to make new pathways to create some sort of organization that just isn't there. And so what happens is, instead of getting really deep trenched neural pathways that may not be ideal for, you know, things like, we may have a lot of protectors and coping strategies that we might want to change later in life, but the brain feels safe with them, versus I'm just throwing out all these nets and nothing is sticking and I'm constantly exhausted and I don't have a plan, you know. Yeah. So that's why, you know, the two things that I want to highlight in that kind of theory that he talks about is, one, when kids are trying to control things, it's literally calming their brainstem. This is not against you. It's not about you. It is not their head, you know, sane, right? So it's not about you when they're trying to control. They're just trying to be predictable. And as much as you can, you know, make things predictable and patterned, you know, have routines, have rituals, have these, you know, sameness, try not to bombard them with too many options.
Right. It's basically our empowering principles coming into play. Yes. And so if we set up their body and their environment in their predictable way, they have a schedule, they know what's coming, all of these things. I also think one thing on top of that is that I think our behavior needs to be predictable. Yes. Like we can't be one way. And when, you know, I mean, of course, like I already told you, I was like, I'm a little grumpy today. I don't know why, right? We're going to have our days, but for the most part, I shouldn't be loving and affectionate one day and yelling and screaming the next when nothing has changed. Yeah. Like I need to be as predictable too, to keep that kid out of that vulnerable space. And when I feel vulnerable, I go to my downstairs brain. I would assume our kids do the same, right? So if we're wanting, we talk a lot about building resilience. I just love that predictable, controllable, and mild is how we can help become and build resilience. And it just felt like this, like, really cool meshing. I had never heard the word vulnerable in that. And nobody likes to be vulnerable, right? Like it's scary. It's, you know, we have safe people we do that with, and our kids are naturally in vulnerable positions always. Right? Always.
And because a lot of them had that unpredictable, you know, they didn't know how it was coming. And so they were vulnerable because their system literally doesn't know how to respond. Because it's never built the good pathways of knowing how to keep themselves safe. And it has to do with safety as well. You know, like, I don't feel safe if I don't know how to keep myself safe.
Yeah. So good. Okay. I really want people to read this. So if you go get the book and you're going to choose your own adventure, then I want to make sure that you start with that first chapter and don't choose your own adventure until you get through it. You used another analogy in this chapter about the air traffic controller and how the patterns of and things are moving. Can you explain that to us? Because it helped my little brain.
I'm so glad it helped your little brain. I feel like there's a lot of people that have a lot of analogies. I travel and I love to travel. And I love to fly. And so I also delight in making associations and kind of creating story out of, you know, inanimate objects and things. And so in my mind, I was like, you know, the brain networks, because they're neural networks, nothing. And that's part of the book too, is nothing happens in isolation. Like I can't just see something. I'm going to see it. I'm going to have feelings about it. I'm going to have an opinion about it. I'm going to hear it as well. It's going to have a memory tied to it. It's probably going to have, you know, if it's red, I'm going to be thinking of other things that are red. If it's round, I'm going to be thinking of other things that are round, because the brain loves associations. It loves to network things together and put them into associations. And, you know, it might raise my heartbeat or it might calm my heartbeat. Like nothing happens singularly with the brain. So when we think about that, we think of all these networks that are developed. So just looking at my red cup, I might get thirsty. I might be transported to a Christmas party because of a memory with red cups. Toby Keith just passed away, you know, this week, and he had a song about the red solo cup. And so I might be thinking of Toby Keith when I think of this red cup because of a very recent event that my brain is going to pull in, right? So the idea that we have structures in our brain that are connected is kind of where that analogy comes from. And sometimes we use the same structure a lot, like the amygdala, you know, and that's going to be whether we're going to remember it or we're going to tie to our previous memories. The thalamus is going to be the center that when we have a sensation and we experience that sensation, you know, do we think it's going to kill us or it's going to be something we can think about? So it's going to relay on to these different areas. And so I got to thinking, it's like a whole bunch of airplanes flying around in my head, following these little networks. And I think about being on a plane and you kind of open up the Sky Mall or whatever, and you see like the hubs of the different cities that that airline uses. And then you see those pathways that they do. And I was like, this kind of looks like my brain. And the pathways for United are going to look really different than the pathways for Southwest Airlines because they're using different hubs. Mm-hmm. And so in my mind, I was like, how can I describe what I just talked about, how we make all these associations and nothing is, there's not just a one-way plane ride. And especially with predictability makes that a frequent trafficked, you know, path, right? Like that trip happens a lot. But if it's not predictable, then it might be like we're sending out 5 or 6 airplanes to different areas of the brain to say, okay, is the vision center going to help me keep safe? Is my memory center going to help me stay safe? Is my, you know, sense of proprioception so I can protect myself physically? You know, like what am I going to connect to? And so I was just kind of thinking about how the brain is really like all these little airports, and some of them are carrying really big, heavy information. So that's a 747. And then other things like, you know, like that red Solo cup, you know, because Toby Keith just passed away, that's going to be like a little Cessna plane, like a little 2-seater private airplane. I'm not going to use that again. Like this is a big memory for me. It's only because it just happened. And that little sensation or that thought or that connection that I made in my brain, it probably isn't even going to stick around. So it's not even going to be a major airport that it's flying into. It's just going to fly to like some little regional airport somewhere. Okay. But the plane's still launched.
Right.
And so thinking through our existence and our experience, and I just love the visual of, you know, that air traffic where we just have all these planes in our brains.
Yes.
Big, some are small, and some are going places that a lot of people are going. And then I, you know, my husband and I were talking about it. And he's like, ooh, and customs is like, you know, customs is like the thalamus where it's like, you're safe or you're not safe. You can come in or you can't. Yep. You know? They stamp your passport and tell you where to go. And then, you know, and we got, I mean, when I was brainstorming this with my husband, we were talking about, you know, and then what kind of luggage you have on the plane and like all these different analogies were coming into play. And it was just really delightful to think about, you know, and they go up the spinal cord, you know, so you've got your sensory information and then you'll have a plane that comes down the spinal cord that's got motor information, you know, so what kind of cargo is on this plane? So I don't know if that helps, but I just.
Absolutely. I want people to see it because it really did. It like helped me to see, you know, how connected we are and how impactful like one little thing can be and how it moves through. And it was really, really helpful. So throughout the rest of the book, you pretty much break down the sensory system, how it's regulated through different parts of the brain. So can we just chat through like each part? You've already told us this is a choose your adventure book, and maybe can you share like a brief example of what it does and then an activity helped for that regulation piece?
Yeah. So again, this is that back part of the book is based off of Dr. Perry's metric that he created. Mm-hmm. And so in that metric, he asks like, how is this, your client's heart rate? How is your client's breathing? How is your client's morality? How is your client's sense of time? You know, like all of these things are questions in that app. So I kind of went through and was like, okay, which ones of these would an OT address in the clinic? And so that's kind of the framework that I used. And so breaking it down, I would say, you know, I kind of did chapters. And again, we look at the things that struct or that hierarchy, that position in the hierarchy will kind of mediate. And then I chose, you know, 3 or 4 things for each one. And then I give lots of examples of think. So I'll just kind of break down the question that you asked me. They would be the brainstem would be part one, and then the diencephalon and the cerebellum, then the limbic area, then the cortex and the frontal cortex, with the understanding that it is hierarchical. So you have to have a solid brainstem if you're ever going to access the cortex. You know, you have to have it, and then the state dependent functioning and all of that. It all works in here. But for the sense of your question, I would say the brainstem is kind of like keep you alive, right? Am I going to be dead or alive? Like without the brainstem, you are literally brainstem dead, right? Like you lose brainstem function, that's when you're clinically dead. So for that, we're looking at heart rate, temperature, food also goes in there as this kind of a survival thing. And so when you look at that chapter, I give suggestions for heart rate and temperature and like how to help with picky eating. And thinking through, like, if your heart rate is not, if you are on an elevated heart rate, then your sense of rhythm is going to be off as well. So your reading is going to be affected. Your sleep is going to be affected. Communication, reciprocity. Can I talk and then let you talk? Can we take turns and have those patterns? Mm. If you don't have rhythm, you're not going to be able to do those things. And so I give you some examples of like working with drums, using different types of music, matching the rhythm of the person and then bringing the rhythm down a little bit to affect the heart rate, you know, going on a run or having them do inverted yoga or, you know, these times of poses and things. Those are all going to affect your heart rate. And so then we move into the diencephalon and the cerebellum. This is your center that really detects threat. So it's a lot of sensory stuff in here because sensations are coming in and being interpreted as, is this a safe sensation or a scary sensation? And so we look a lot at like sensory integrated processing and sleep in this area. And so if you don't have good sleep, then you're not going to have the bandwidth, if you will, to deal with the sensory stimulation. And that's what you'll see when people are tired. They're like, oh, everything is just too loud. That light is too bright. I'm too tired to deal with this. You're too noisy. You know, like sleep fits in this diencephalon cerebellum
region. Maybe that's why I'm grumpy today. If you Super Bowl didn't, last night. I was up too late.
I know. Our Jason Kelsey was saying we should make this a holiday where we don't have to go to work. But
it should be. He's right.
Sleepy Sunday is what it was called. Or Sleepy Monday. but so that chapter, I kind of bring in activities of, you know, can we help with safety by bringing in something soft or something chewy, something sweet, something cold? You know, how do we use sensations to really help decrease the threat response in the brain, you know, from that brain level? And then the limbic system, the limbic area is like our emotions and feelings. So a lot of the stuff in the limbic area, the recommendations are about relations and matching our energy with the person so that we're in relationship with them. A lot of co-regulatory strategies like standing next to them, going for a walk with them, keeping the same pace as you're walking with them. So a lot of that like physical co-regulation, swinging next to them would be something. And even adjusting our expectations so that we can stay in that relationship and not have the disconnect of, you know, the disappointment and the frustration because we're expecting too much from them. That's never going to be that. So a lot of suggestions around that in the limbic area. And then the cortex is where we start to think. And so the questions around, you know, finding the what needs to be mediated there would be around communication, right? And like, can you communicate? And so there's using verbal communication versus making a vision, like a visual board to communicate with somebody. We talk a lot in that chapter about the tone of our voice, our facial expressions, talking about using rhythm again to kind of help with that taking turns in conversation. And so the activities that are recommended for the cortex are a lot of things that are going to help you be thoughtful and communicate and, you know, working on a little bit of that, you know, relating and all and into the bridging into reason a little bit more or connecting you know, like the thinking part of like the, we used to use correcting. I'm not sure what the new terminology is or whatnot, but like that being in a relationship where your opinion matters to me and I want to, you know, be able to be in a community, you know, with that as well. And and that kind of thing. So then the last chapter of that section is the frontal cortex, which is thoughts and planning and morals. And a lot of that is just ideas of how to model that for people. Mm-hmm. And people don't want to be told what to feel or why they're moral. No. Like, we're learning that in America right now. I can't tell you, you know, what to believe and things like that. I have to show you my faith.
For right.
You want that faith as well. And just really a lot more of that, you know, co-regulation, mindfulness of how we're presenting ourselves, and then also teaching versus punishing, you know. And so there's a lot of vocabulary around that, because I think people want to give a punishment, and then recognizing that the reason I can't plan this through or I can't think it through is because I really don't know how to do it. So I have to teach you how to do it first. Yeah. And then after that section, then I get into, there's a whole chapter on, people ask me, like, what's your evaluative process? Like, if I were to come to you, what would you do? Right. And so I just lay that out. If you come to the farm, you know, this is my vow. And then the last chapter, I think, is, and then I have one on how do we adapt this to different environments? So, like, let's say we're in a residential facility versus, you know, a state-run facility, or, you know, a two-person household versus 40-person household, you know, like those kinds of things. It's our school-based. I even have, like, if you're working on a farm, because I work on a farm. And so kind of modeling the activities based on our environments. Mm-hmm. And then I go into those cheap, inexpensive, you know, if you want to have a hammock swing, but you don't want to spend $60 on it, here's how you go to Home Depot and, you know, go to a fabric store and get some things. So really just walking through how to do that as well.
So Marty, I heard food issues. Mm-hmm. I heard sleep.
Oh yeah.
I heard regulation. I heard relationship. I heard teaching, which would also mean somebody's has an ability to learn. And I think these are, like, some of the most common issues people come to us with. And, you know, behavior's just a subset of all of that, right? Like, really just an expression of all of that. And so
activity analysis, you find that these things are your things.
Right. Yes. It all comes back to, are we meeting them where they are with what they need in order to help them get to where we're going? Yeah. Oh my gosh. You guys, you got to buy the book. Marty, where do you find the book?
I do know that in Austin, the book people will be carrying it in the Austin area, which is really cool.
That's so cool.
Amazon for sure. You can pre-order it now.
Okay, Marty, people can definitely find it on Amazon. We know that for sure. Book people for sure. And we think Barnes & Noble. We will link that stuff in the show notes, so they'll be able to find it without a problem. Also, if you have not checked out Marty's book, The Connected Therapist, I highly encourage you to do that.
The Connected Therapist is what sets the stage. You know, I feel like it's going to change your life. And once you've read that book, if you want to go a little deeper and you want to choose your own adventure kind of stuff, this is the step two to that book.
Yeah, I think having, you know, experience with both of them, I would start with a Connected Therapist, but I would absolutely buy this book, because the activities and the connection to the brain and it being so digestible for me, it really blew me away. So I love both of them.
I'm so excited if someone picks it up and just really gets to understand a little bit better why. And the other thing in this book, where the Connected Therapist did, if your child's having trouble with sleep, try these things, right?
Right.
But this book is, if your child's having trouble with sleep, this is the part of the brain that's having trouble with that. And this is why you're having trouble with sleep. And so it really just goes a little deeper into each of the subcategories, the subcategories that lead to the behaviors.
Really. Right. Oh man, it's so good. I'm excited. I can't wait to see the launch. And I just thank you again for partnering with us and journeying with us and sharing your work with us.
The TBRI podcast is produced by the Karen Purvis Institute of Child Development at TCU. To learn more about TBRI and the resources mentioned in this episode, please visit child.tcu.edu/podcast.